myself, the Republican Finance, that we have the initial briefing when the bills are ready and not wait until the end. Although it must have to go first to the National Assembly, that we start with the initial briefing to get clarity on things. And when it eventually is being referred to us, that it go more quickly then. I just want you to go back to the map. I'll tell you why. Mr. Tomaszek, remember, the other one. Yeah. In the Northern Cape. 33% of South Africa. There's an office in Kimberley and there's an office in Upington.
But they're giving
3%
of the...
Yeah, whoa. Let's come on. Big ones got your apple then. At one of our previous meetings, I put a request, and the minister was present at one of the meetings, to look at the western part of the Northern Cape. If you look at development, it's lacking. But leave that, that's another debate. The capital town here is Springbok, on the western side. And the request was, can SARS look at the opening a facility in Springbok? 2 weeks ago in the newspaper, they call it a Gemsbok, you get it in Upington. It's a regional newspaper. There was an advertisement, SARS is coming. Now thank you, SARS, we are arriving in Springbok for 2 or 3 days. I think that is coming forth from what we asked in one of our meetings. That's a step in the right direction, but if you can formulate it, maybe a small office to service the people. And then if you would recall, Mr. Tomaszek, Honorable Lees, coming from KZN, requested the same thing for Vryheid Dundee, the rural part of KZN. So I'm just taking you back a few months about that, and that we keep it on the agenda to look at our people in rural areas. Rural areas, because they are clients of SARS and contributing to the revenue of South Africa. So thank you that I could do that. One of our oversight points will be the customs and the border post at Komatipoort, seeing that we pass the bill on the one stop. Right, honourable members, questions. I had my turn. Honourable Motara, Honourable Matlashuping, Honourable Von Brandes, Honourable Leni, in that order, you are last. Right? Kick off.
Thanks, Jay. Okay, let me thank SARS first for their presentation, but also just to stress that going forward, if you can make the presentations available to us early, because as members of the NCOP, we have a lot of work that we deal with, and we aren't able to prepare adequately if we receive the presentations late. But it's fine, because this was just a pre-presentation almost to the kind of work that you do. In your presentation, you mentioned that SARS doesn't have a board, but according to your Act, Part 3, it makes provision for the establishment of an advisory board. Now, I don't think it lies with SARS particularly, but with the Minister of Finance. But I think from my side, as a point of concern, that it has not been established and doesn't exist. But it's something that maybe we must take up with the Minister of Finance. That's the first thing. The second question relates to the Ombudsman. If you can please give us clarity on the current status of the Ombudsman. The Ombudsman was seconded from SARS as a personnel from SARS. But in my understanding, an Ombudsman must be separate to, because if I can't go to somebody as a who's a referee and a player to mediate on an issue that I have with somebody that I'm complaining about. So if you can just give us clarity onto the in relation to the current status of the ombudsman.
Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. The Honorable Motara is sitting next to me.
Oh.
So she spoke before me, and I wanted to raise issues that are in the act that she raised based on the presentation, particularly on the accounting officer and the executive authority, because we had a stroke there in the presentation. And I said to myself, how then do you become a player and a referee at the same time? Because the act is very clear in terms of who the executive authority is and the accounting officer is. Thank you.
On the mobile, let's take it in that way, and then on both on Brandes.
Thanks, Chair. Well, first, is to acknowledge that SARS is one of the outstanding institutions in South Africa. I think they've distinguished themselves through their work over the period.
Yes.
And that being the case, we have noted the areas of improvement that they have highlighted. But I'm just interested to just get a benefit. According to SARS, are there industries that are difficult in terms of collection? Because revenue constitute an important area now, especially now that we're going through this period. The revenue is an important element of our envelope that seeks to address much of our problem. But industries, for an example, in the whether is it construction industry or what, but what are pertinent issues with regard to industries around issues of collection? I note here on the small business segments that we need to do some improvement, but just really to benefit on the broad areas. But the issue of ports of entry, what happens to goods that are not supposed to be in South Africa and they find themselves landing in our ports of entry? What do we do? Thanks.
I just want to say thank you also for SARS for their presentation. And also, it's good, the good story here. This pre-population of PIT returns, you know, that's a very good story. Congratulations with that, and also forward. On page 14 of your handout, the top slide, it's about the customs. It's about the total number of arrivals and departures. Now, I took with my thick finger here on a small calculator. I worked out that we had a surplus here of 4.9 million people. That's something that's worrying someone somewhere, I'm sure, because we're getting more people in than going out. And that's not the right thing. That must balance out the situation. Or otherwise, we're getting, in this short period of time, in 3 years' time, we're getting 5 million people coming into South Africa that's not leaving South Africa. Thank you.
Actually, we must have Home Affairs here as well to deal with that one. I don't know how SARS can deal with it, but... Mr. McLeany.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a few questions here. One of them, of course, it's a cause for concern as to the player and the referee at the same time, which have already been forwarded to you by colleagues here. I just want to know if maybe... My first question, if you, as SARS, do interact with minerals and energy, if maybe you do play any role in the fluctuation of fuel, which seems to be bringing more misery to workers and non-workers of this country, the fluctuation of fuel. I just want to know if Is it only minerals and energy, or yourself you are also taking part in this one? This one also, I also want to know if when it comes to customs and excise, I want you to maybe if you've got maybe when it comes to fraudulent cases or activities, I want you to know to inform us if you do you have any maybe government officials involved in these cases, and if so, how many cases are finalized and how many are still pending. I think this can also be, I can also refer to, you know, foreigners, because I learned recently that, you know, 10% of cases that SARS has, this is subject to correction. More of these cases are actually done by foreigners. I also want maybe need clarity on that one. And maybe the next one is, I just want to know if maybe you are linked to government institutions and also private sector. Those who are actually receiving tenders as tender planners. Of course, this will be able to enable you to keep abreast as to who actually owns tax, because you only read once after a while that so-and-so has been jailed for tax evasion. So we would also like to know on that one. And I've got another one which is also a cause for serious concern. There are those widows who receive, you know, money's widows or widowers who receive, you know, pension from their late husbands or late wives. We have had many times had this kind of complaints that it's like they're being taxed twice. And we try to take this to relevant stakeholders, but we haven't received an answer as yet on this one. And maybe at the end of the day today, we'll be knowing exactly what is actually taking place, because they complain that their money is being taxed twice. And then that person who happens to be a deceased was actually paying tax. So the large sum of amount which remains for either the living wife or the living husband is taxed again. We want to know why that. And maybe lastly, let me also ask you about the arrest that you make. We read more in newspapers that, you know, you are actually doing more arrests in the port of entry. So I want to know if you are making a follow-up on these cases. Do you have a special team which is actually specializing on doing follow-ups on these cases? I'll reserve the reason why I'm asking this question. Thank you.
Good, Heller.
Thank you for the opportunity to present. One is very happy with your presentation. It's eye-opening. I'm happy to have something to say, then I must show this map here so that I can also see where I'm coming from. I'm basically from that town there that's called Mthatha. That town there services about close to 12 or 14 small towns around it. And your office is right there in that town. Mthatha. Yeah, you service close to 10 different towns there. Now, what I want to ask from you regarding that town, previously you had an office right in town. I see now you've opened a new office, which is bit out of town, which is going to cost the taxpayers, who are very poor people, who travel from these small towns. In other words, they go to now travel double from Mthatha, they have to travel out of Mthatha again. Now, what is the rationale of opening an office built out of Mthatha? Because this affects the poor people. I know maybe you don't decide about your office, maybe it's public works, but really I just don't understand, because it's costing the poorest of the poor too much money to get to your offices. In fact, you've opened an office in Northcrest. Northcrest is a suburb out of Mthatha. In other words, the people are there then to double transport Chairperson to the SARS office. Then secondly, do you have somebody who's assisting the small businesses? I meet a lot of them, complaints. Some of them, they can't get their clearance because they've done this and that, but you need that person who can assist, because they do not understand that they can maybe come to you. Some of them run away from you. There's a lot of them who run away. Some of them have closed their businesses because some of them are not even paid by the government, by the department, which is not your problem anyway. I agree with that, it's not your problem. But it affects them because they then cannot pay you. Would you have somebody that can do that type of service to those business people? Because it's very important. It affects what we then, as a government policy, we want to assist small businesses. But at the end, most of them close their business down, which they can just come to you and sit down and talk to you. But have you got somebody who's got that experience? Well, it needs experience. You know, some of your guys are like accountants. You know, when an accountant says, I want my money now, you know. Sometimes it's good, sometimes to sit down and explain to this is what we need from you. Thank you. Oh, the last
thank one. You.
Sorry. There are quite a lot of shops mushrooming all over those TBV states. Most of them are people who come from outside South Africa, Pakistan, blah, 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 blah. But most of them don't pay taxes. I see Joburg and all, you do raid and all that. When can you do that in that area? The area from Mthatha, those surrounding towns. It would be good if you can do that, because some of them are just mushrooming and the money is getting out of the country. Thank you.
Yeah, speaking of the former TBV states, we speak of the former Homelands policy. That's how we were dealt with that. The former Minister of Finance, Pravin Gordhan, was in his other life the SARS Commissioner. And they turned, him and his team turned around SARS.
No doubt.
And we're actually seeing now the result. A very, very more professional institution than they were. The first time I completed my tax return forms, I think it was 14 pages. Yeah, it was writing a thesis. It took you a whole day to do that.
You must have a
and you had
income.
No business, you just had one income, and that's all. But that is where we were and where we are now. Being more professional. And again, I want to mention the office in Kimberley. It's a pleasure to go into that office and to be attended to in a very professional way. And I told the people that I'm going to say that in the committee meeting. And I go back to them and tell them, oh, we've did that. Because we must compliment those who are doing their work in an excellent way. Thank you for the questions. Mr. Lowe and your team, you've got 20 minutes to reply.
Thank you, Chair. I'll kick off and then my colleagues must come in where I perhaps missed something. certainly, Chair, when we take note of the points, and thank you for the compliments as far as the officers are concerned, Kimberley, on the Springbok and area, etc., I'll take it back to my colleagues and I'll certainly find out, you know, what the plans and are as far as that is concerned. Because it is certainly so, when there are
some vast distances that some people must travel in that sort of Northern Cape, northern that part of the world. And it is our intention to ultimately increase our footprint so that people are sort of closer to, as far as the offices are concerned. Although it is so that we nowadays, we try to interact, you know, mostly by way of electronic communication, but there are still people who would like and who can't access us through electronic means and who still wants and who needs to come in physically to have their problems sorted out. So it's something that we're definitely working on, and I'll take that message back, Chair. Thank you. On the question around the board, I don't know, I must apologize. I think the version that was handed out of the SARS Act was the original SARS Act as it was promulgated in the Government Gazette. But we've amended the SARS Act since then. Andrew, I think... no, where's Andrew? I think we must give him a copy of the amended version of the SARS Act. Because what has happened, we have... Yes, it is so. When SARS was created, there was... an advisory board, but it was not a decision-making board. It was only an advisory board that was established in terms of the Act. And the board was actually implemented, the advisory board. But since then, we've done away. The Act was amended. The board was abolished because it was only an advisory board. It didn't have any decision-making powers. And it was substituted by committees. So if you look at the new version of the Act, you will see that the Act makes provision for, I think there's two committees that it mentions in the Act. The one is an HR committee and the one is a technical committee that can give advice as far as technical issues are concerned. But both of them are also advisory committees. They are not decision-making committees. So currently we do not have a board. The advisory board has been abolished. and even so, at the time, it wasn't an accounting authority because it only had advisory powers. It didn't have decision-making powers. Currently, we only have two committees that advise us, but they're not at the level of accounting authorities. So the commissioner is the accounting officer for SARS, as it currently stands. Sorry? Like a DG, the same as a DG. As far as the tax ombud is concerned, we've done quite a bit of research before we advised the minister, and the minister made a decision on the implementation of the tax ombud's office. We looked at various countries. We looked at the Canadian model. We looked at the UK model, the American model, the Australian one. So we looked at quite a number of them. In the end, we followed a bit of a hybrid between the Canadian and the UK model, where the office, the people actually working in the office are people seconded from the tax authority. The tax ombud itself is not appointed by SARS. The tax ombud itself is appointed by the Minister of Finance. So that's where the level of independence then comes in. The ombud has a contract with the minister. The minister negotiates the contract. The ombud also reports to the minister, and the tax ombud must file an annual report to the Minister of Finance, and the law specifies what type of minimum information must be in that report, and issues that the ombud picks up. It can be systematic issues or system issues, any trends that it picks up, etc., etc. And the minister can ultimately table that report in Parliament. So Parliament will ultimately also have oversight, actually, and have a say as far as this is concerned. So I think that's where the level of the independence comes in. I think one of the reasons... that also ultimately persuaded the minister to structure the office in this way, because otherwise you had to create almost like a separate legal entity or a separate entity governing the office of the tax ombud. And then that would have been a public entity in its own right with its own reporting structures, etc. Currently, the office of the tax ombud can use all the infrastructure of SARS. They can use our systems, they can use all the resources that they require from SARS. You don't have to go and create a new HR structure for them or an IT structure for them, etc. So they can piggyback on the structures as far as SARS is concerned. The personnel of the tax ombud, although they are people seconded from SARS, it is not people that the ombud must just accept from SARS. The tax ombud can select those people from SARS. So it's not a question that SARS will say to the tax ombud, take these 10 or 20 people, etc. It is done in consultation with the tax ombud. The tax ombud can even insist on the appointment of new people, although those people will then be appointed on the staff structure of SARS, but then seconded to the office of the tax ombud. But as I say, the reason for that was not to go and create duplicate systems, HR and IT, etc., systems, and a new public entity. That was the idea behind it. And that's more or less how it also works in Canada and in the UK. I think in the UK and France can come in here. I think in the UK is it the tax advocate or adjudicator, what they call them in there, but France can come in here. But there, I think the person actually reports to the tax authority, not even to the minister. And maybe France, you can come in here on this one before I carry on with the rest of the questions.
Thank you, Gosi. Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it brief because we, in fact, still have the paper that we prepared for the committees when the legislation was passed available on our website. So if you want to do the background reading, it's quite available. But essentially in the UK, as Gosi correctly points out, the tax adjudicator is appointed by HMRC on contract and reports to HMRC. In Canada, and Canada is always a useful example because they have a constitutional system roughly similar to ours. Again, it's appointed by the ombud is appointed by the minister. And in the United States, the ombud is appointed, if I remember correctly, by the Secretary of the Treasury, but reports to the Commissioner and to Congress. Okay, so you have a mix of systems. And one other important point to bear in mind is taxpayer information is confidential. We try and keep it that way. It's required by law. And keeping it within the SARS structure also assists in preserving the confidentiality because you don't have yet another group of people who are accessing that information. You can bring them in under the same legal prescripts and requirements that a SARS official would be brought in. And as I say, we did look at the international models. One thing to bear in mind is that in South Africa you also have the public protector, who's yet another super ombud for the whole of government. And you also have to take that into account in designing what your structure looks like. But if members are interested, we can certainly provide you with a copy of the background paper that was prepared that gives you that international benchmark and gives you a sense of how we arrived at the model that was finally decided on.
It will be a good thing to circulate that because we work with a bigger picture. We work globally as finance committee in the NCOB. Thank you.
Then ultimately the ombud that was appointed was a retired judge. It was a judge in Gwepe, so it is not somebody from SARS. It was it's an external person, and as it was a person of the standing of a retired judge, which I think is the type of profile of a person that can express his or her independence. I may also just mention that most of the crucial staff in the office of the tax ombud were recruited by the ombud himself. Mostly the people who came from SARS are people who work in the back office, etc. But most of the staff who are actually in the decision-making positions are people that the ombud picked himself. Chair, the next question was around areas or industries that it might be difficult to deal with and perhaps might not be so compliant. We have, I think, published a compliance program, I think a year or two ago, that actually lists some of the industries that we, based on an analysis that we have done, that we sort of highlighted as risk areas. Some of those areas, I think, were the construction industry. It was the illicit economy, tobacco. Tobacco industry, we have lots of problems as far as that illegal cigarettes that are coming into South Africa. I think the estimate is that almost a quarter of all cigarettes that are being consumed in South Africa are illegal cigarettes. So it's a huge, it's a massive problem for us. Those people manage then ultimately to bring these cigarettes in without payment of customs duties and VAT, and they have a huge economic advance over other traders who are paying their fair share of duty. So you can see that tax that they don't pay gives them an advantage in the market, that they can sell their products and make a much bigger profit on those. So that's definitely an area that we are looking at. Trusts is a big area, is a vehicle that is being used to avoid taxation and different kinds of tax. It ranges from income tax, from estate duty, etc. So trusts are vehicles that are being used, especially by high net worth individuals, to minimize their tax position. So that's an area that we are looking at as well. Small business is also an area, although small business has got the two components. Yes, there's the small businesses. We will try, and I'll come back to small business later on, that those businesses who wants to work with us and who wants to be compliant, that they need to get more support from us. But there are a big part of small business that are just outside the our radar screen, and they are just not on our systems. They're just not registered. And those you can, there are, I think, a foreign element to it, but there's a South African element to it as well. Transfer pricing and multinational companies using all sorts of techniques to minimize their tax position is an area that we must also look at. Funds can perhaps later come in. This is not just a South African problem or a problem that's unique to South Africa, but it's a universal problem where multinational companies are structuring themselves that they shift many of their profits to jurisdictions where there is no taxation or very low rates that are being applied. And the OECD, which is an international organization, and France has just come back. He was seconded to the OECD for a year, and he worked on a project what they called BEPS. It is base erosion and profit shifting, and France can perhaps talk a little bit about that. I think there's about 14 or 15 initiatives that they're looking at, and France worked on one of those initiatives. What we can do from an international perspective to make sure that companies pay their fair share of tax in the country where they're actually operating. I'm sure many of you have read of these big multinational companies like Google and Starbucks and all of them, how they've minimized their tax position by billions of dollars and moving their profits to tax havens, etc., and not paying that. And we are seeing some of that in South Africa as well. and it's an area that we need to concentrate on and put some focus on as well. Ports and goods that are not supposed to come into South Africa, what are we doing about it? Well, the ideal is actually to stop those goods before it actually to our shores, and if possible, not to allow those goods to be actually offloaded in South Africa. That's why, and I mentioned earlier on, the reporting structures now starts at a much earlier stage when goods are loaded in a harbor of a departing country, they need to start sending us reports that we start to know what is actually being loaded onto these ships. But obviously, with criminals involved, they won't always tell you the truth as far as that is concerned, and you might not get the correct report. So where we can, we will try and stop it even before it reaches our shores. If it so happens that the goods are in South Africa and these goods are illegal or unwanted goods in South Africa, the customs laws grants us extensive powers how to deal with it. We can confiscate those goods. We can store them in warehouses until we have decided what ultimately should happen it. And here we work closely with many of the our sister departments. For example, if it's counterfeit goods, we need to consult with trade and industry. If it's agricultural products that came in that should not come in, we need to talk to agriculture or health or whoever it is that we need to consult with to ultimately, before we take a decision, what must happen to those goods. And different things can happen to it. We can ultimately decide to destroy those goods, or we can decide that the goods must be re-exported from South Africa, or they are depending on the facts of the matter. We will then ultimately have to make a decision what we do with those goods. On the numbers of people coming in and going out, those are the gross numbers that we got. I think obviously there are things that one should take into consideration, such as time differences as well. So it can in different periods can overlap. People might come in and then go back in a different period. I think migrant workers, I think, distorts the picture to a very, very large extent. So that's why you might see that there are more people in South Africa than outside of it, because there are hundreds of thousands of migrant workers working in South Africa. But it's a good point, and we can follow up on that. And we will have to work with our Home Affairs colleagues, because the people processing is not really our functioning. Yeah. Our function. We look at the goods that those people carry. That's actually our focus. So the people issue is actually Home Affairs issue ultimately. On minerals and energy, what are we doing as far as fluctuations are concerned? Unfortunately, there's not a lot that we can actually do from our side, but we do work with mineral and energy affairs as far as mining is concerned, sometimes on mining issues, but that's more focused on the taxation of mining, on how to treat mines sometimes where, say, two mines are working close, adjoining mines, and whether decision needs to be taken whether to treat those two mines as one single mine. On those type of issues, we will work with these departments also on the rehabilitation of mines. There are areas that we work with, but as far as the workforce and of issues are concerned, that's pretty much sort of outside our control, Chair. Maybe I understood the question incorrectly. Maybe if you can elaborate a little bit, then I can we can try and build on it.
I think it was just that
my question was based on the fluctuation of fuel.
The price.
Do you have an upper hand on that, or is just minerals and energy alone? Because there's
of the price problem. Of minerals and so on.
No, fuel in particular.
Petrol
and
fuel.
Yes.
Okay.
We still have 6 minutes left, all the members.
Okay. Yeah. The price of fuel, we do not have any control as far as that is concerned, Chair. No. we collect then the fuel levies and so on, all the different kinds of fuel levies that we collect. But as far as the price is concerned, we do not have any control as far as that. Treasury ultimately decides on the fuel levy and the rates, and you will see that that is adjusted annually. The fuel taxes on the fuel, that's normally adjusted in line with the inflation. But on the price levels of the fuel, we do not have any influence as far as that is concerned, Chair. The involvement of government officials and foreigners in illegal businesses or businesses that are not on register, Chair, I can't give you any numbers specifically. We can go back and see. It is so that sometimes, and unfortunately, even from SARS, from time to time, we find that there are some officials that are getting involved in these sort of practices. We nowadays find that you have these sort of, syndicates that are infiltrating, you know, government and business, etc. And these syndicates are made up of people, you know, from different kinds of industries and different kinds of government departments. We find it nowadays also with for example, fraudulent activities to make that they sort of identity theft, for example, is one thing, where syndicates would work together with people in banks, in SARS, in other departments, etc., to steal the identity of somebody. And then what they would do, they would then make sure that way then, if a refund is due to you, they would steal your identity and change your bank details so that the refund that's due to you actually lands up in the hands of a different person. We're trying our utmost, Chair. I mean, it is a huge problem, but we're working together. Now, that's why we're working much closer together with Home Affairs now, so that the data that Home Affairs collect is the correct data. We work very closely with the financial institutions, with the banks, to verify before refunds goes out, to make sure that the refund goes to the correct account and that is to the correct person's account, etc. But unfortunately, it still happens, but we try and keep our finger on the pulse on this one. But unfortunately so, as the world advances and electronics can make your life easy in many instances, it also offers opportunities, many, many opportunities for unscrupulous people who want to, you know, steal money from other people as well. But it's something, as soon as we discover it, we try and act as quickly as possible. We get those people out of the system as quickly as possible. And we can perhaps, Elisa, maybe when we're back, if we can get numbers of people that we have already suspended over and reported to the NPA and to the police as far as that is concerned, maybe from a SARS perspective, we can give you those numbers. The issue of pensions of widowers and widows, I'm not sure whether there's any double taxation involved. What happens normally from a pension point of view? Maybe we should explain the bigger picture in the first instance. When you start to save through a pension scheme, in the first instance, during your lifetime, you contribute to a pension. Those contributions you can normally claim as a deduction in terms of the tax system. So you're not taxed on that part of your income that you contribute to a pension scheme. Then, while you're saving, that money then builds up in the pension fund. We've exempt the pension fund, so your money is invested tax-free in the pension fund. So your build-up in the fund is tax-free over your lifetime. Then when you retire, the money comes out of the pension. And there's two types of pension schemes that you can get. There's the contribution type scheme and the benefit type of scheme. The contribution, retirement benefit, defined contribution one and the defined benefit one. Now, the defined contribution one allowed you that you can invest your money in the fund, and when you withdraw one day, you can withdraw all your money. You can withdraw the full capital on a lump sum basis out of the fund. Although we've proposed new rules now to align it to the defined benefit type of scheme. The defined benefit type of scheme normally works on the basis that you leave two-thirds of your capital that you've built up over your life in the fund, and you can withdraw one-third as a lump sum. The two-thirds that you leave in the fund is then the capital that is used to pay your annuity or your monthly pension that you, for the remaining part of your life. Now that the lump sum that you get, there's a specific formula. There's a part of that is tax-free. I think it's about 320. So it's 500 now. 500 is tax-free when you. The balance is taxed in terms of a separate formula in terms of the Tax Act. The annuity that you get or the monthly pension, that has always been taxed. And the reason why it has been taxed, because you could put your money tax-free into the fund up front. We allowed you to get the tax deduction up front, your money built up tax-free in the fund. So that's why they call it the EET system. It's exempt when you put your money in. It's exempt. The second E stands for exempt while your money grows in the fund. And the last T stands when it's taxed, when it comes out of the fund. So that's why the annuity is taxed. And so when the person who saved, say it was the husband who saved, and if, say, if the husband passes away, and then the annuity continues after his passing away, but although it's a smaller annuity that is then paid. Sometimes it's halved, after the main beneficiary passes away. But then it still continues. It remains taxable. So there's no double taxation as far as the annuity is concerned. What sometimes happens is, say, for example, the spouse, the remaining spouse, now gets the annuity from the spouse that passed away. And the remaining spouse is also working. Now that person gets two streams of income. And those two streams of income are combined. And because our personal income tax system works on a progressive basis, in other words, the higher your income, the higher your tax rates. Then it sometimes happens. Then it happens because you combine the two incomes that that person has got at the end of the year has got to pay an additional amount of tax. We have now, I think we've published something to allow people or the so that you can ask your employer or your pension fund to deduct a higher amount from one of the income streams so that you can sort of pay during the year a higher amount of tax so that when at the end of the year, when the two sources of income are combined, that you are not hit with such a high tax bill at the end of the year. That's the only area that we normally get some complaints where these two income streams are joined, that there's an additional amount of tax payable.
I just want to sensitize members that there's a SARS office on the premises in 90 Plain Street. Which floor? On the 8th floor. Mrs. Morgan is working
yes.
there.
Yeah.
And will assist any time within office hours the assistant to members. We will have to speed up our reply, please.
Okay.
We're going to run into a time problem.
Yes. Sorry, the UMTATA office, unfortunately, I can't comment specifically on that. It's the office in UMTATA. Apparently, they opened a new office, as I understand, outside the... we will find out what the issue was there. Normally, when we secure a new premises, we put it out on tender, and there's a tender process, but I'll try and find out what the issue is there. On small businesses, as I mentioned during my presentation, it is an area that we want to try and put more focus on. Ultimately, we would like to move to the situation where in most of our branch offices that we can have a dedicated box there or a counter for small business so that people can go there and that there is a knowledgeable person there that can service them. The TBVC states and foreigners operating, it is part of the drive. That's why we are working very closely with Home Affairs and with the company's office and the master's office to try and identify which businesses are not on the register. I don't think we can, it's correct just to single out foreigners. We have to treat all taxpayers, whether you're a foreigner or whether you're a South African, on the same basis, the same rules apply to you, but all taxpayers should pay tax if you operate in South Africa, whether you're a foreigner or whether you're a South African. And we are in the process to, we also want to work closer with SALGA, with the municipalities now. We're going to get third-party information from them as well. So I think we're going to try and draw the nets closer and closer and smaller so that nobody can escape the tax net ultimately. Yes, Chair, I think that's more or less it. Thank you very much, Chair. I hope I covered all that.
Yes, no, I think you covered everything plus the rest. Yes, Honourable Member.
Chair, I thought I must raise this matter just before you summarize and close.
Yes.
I take serious exception of what happened now. And what comes to my mind is the fact that we were distributed a document that is called the Act, and we have been duly informed that it is amended. And I'm questioning myself the authenticity of documents that are always distributed to us and that we have not made an input on them, whether they are really authentic, because we would have, if we would have not raised this matter, we would have remained with this Act, we would have read it and thought this is the only document that is authentic. I take very serious exception of what has happened. Thank you.
The point is noted. This document must be handed back to the person who brought it here, and that the latest version of the Act that's in practice be circulated. So thank you for that point. It is noted. Mr. Lowe, to you and your team, Mr. Tomacek, Mr. Mele, Kumalo, and Piki, thank you for your honoring this appointment, for the briefing and the way you did it. And we will engage with you in the very near future when we deal with the amendment bills on taxation. We wish you a safe journey back home. Please don't fly via the Ukraine. That's a dangerous area to go to. We're going to release you. We've got some other business to deal with quickly. So we will release you until further notice when we call you again. I want to... Yeah, August and September, we're going to see them again. Just be patient on the members. Can you please give each member a document? You are released. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. And apologies for the Act. We'll make sure that the revised version is...
Yeah, decision. Just give that document back, please. Thank you. Honourable Members, since Monday there were certain developments regarding the province of Limpopo. As you know and would have read, there's intervention that was invoked on the 5th of December 2011 in five provincial departments in the province of Limpopo. That intervention in terms of Section 101B was referred to the Select Committee for Finance, And in terms of rule 105 of the rules of the NCOP, to engage with the relevant committees dealing with the intervention. The document you've got in your hand is the last report and the official position of the National Council of Provinces referring to the intervention in Limpopo. That was ATC'd on the 18th of November 2013 and on the 21st of November with a cover letter sent to the Minister of Finance. Then it takes its route to Cabinet, referring to the recommendations that are captured in the report. I received a copy of a letter that was addressed to the chairperson of the NCOP, Honorable Modise, written by the Minister of Finance, Honorable Nene, referring to the amendment or invoking Section 101A of the Constitution in terms of what is happening in the Republic. I met with the Honorable Minister.